Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Reported that Theresa May is facing a battle to cling to power in the coming days because party rivals are threatening to unseat her as leader. Now, she has warned at the time, of course, it's a critical time at the moment because they're trying to achieve a successful Brexit. But what does a successful Brexit look like? And is the draft deal giving us a good picture of that? And will Theresa May survive? And maybe a good place to start is just the background to all of this, because there's been so much discussion, so much analysis, but actually, are the majority of us any the wiser? Well, our next guest will certainly help us to do just that, to get a little bit wiser and give us an update on the current situation in relation to Brexit. Our regular political commentator, Susan Phillips. Susan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Let's backtrack a little bit, okay? Let's just kind of go a bit more into where we are now and where we're going.
I think that's a good idea. The EEC started as an idea to stop France and Germany pulling the guts out of each other, which they had twice in the century. And it started as, I'm making it very simple, it started as a trading issue as well as a putting the weapons of destruction out of the way. And Britain and Ireland joined up at the same time, 1963. There were about 12 then. And it became a trading situation. Barriers came down, tariffs were removed, and it was a very popular idea. But the central Brussels, whatever you'd like to call them, the people in charge, began, it seemed, to make too many political rules. So trade, yes, but then difficult regulations. And the EU was becoming slightly criticized for having done that. So go back to Britain, and in June 2016, the British called for a referendum. It was David Cameron's idea because his backbenchers were saying, look, our constituents are getting very upset about these huge number of migrants coming into Britain. They're getting all the social securities, and we want to take back our sovereign colonialist, you know, empire-building perspectives. And to everybody's surprise, the Brexiteers, those are the ones that wanted to come out of the EU, just won. So fast forward a little bit, and Mrs. May has to put Article 50, which she had to obey her people, and Article 50 in March 2017 starts the process of removing Britain from the EU. However,
2 years later, we're still talking about it.
Yes, but Wendy, what happened was that not long after that, the EU, this is, and the UK, that's still Mrs. May, they signed up to this situation, which said, we will be negotiating, we'll have an argument, we'll have to have a divorce settlement, but we both agree there will be no hard physical customs post border between the north and the south of Ireland, because the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 has to be protected, and to put it in simple words, the IRA would reform at the next customs post. And that has been the basis of the whole problem, because it would be quite easy to do a deal. If you're going to do a Brexit deal, you'll say, right, we'll all move out. But you can't when you've got this backstop which says that whatever happens, there will be no hard border. And that is the problem.
So it brings us forward now to what happened last week. I think it was last Wednesday that the draft deal was agreed. And people were kind of saying, you know, OK, a huge amount of work has been done. It didn't take long before, you know, opinion and analysis came in. And I see even Tony Blair writing an opinion piece today, basically saying that it's a bad deal for both sides. He says it isn't liked by the British Parliament or the British people, even a significant part of the remaining cabinet. Is he right?
Well, what happened was that on the 14th of November, the UK cabinet said, we have agreed a new draft deal. And they said, this is what it is. They said that the basis of this agreement, it was to be a little bit different from Chequers, because as you remember, after Chequers, which was a few months ago, David Davis and Boris Johnson, the two Brexiteers, they hopped out of the cabinet. So it had to be slightly harder for some and softer for others. And the basis of the agreement, which was announced on the 14th of November, you saw poor Mrs. May standing there saying her cabinet was united, which actually they were not. But the basis, Wendy, is very simple. It covered future trading relations. It covered the money, because the UK has to pay 39 billion. And you say, why? And it's because of money, it's for financial liabilities that accrued over a few years. So I think that's perfectly fair. And then it was the Northern Irish border and what happens to UK citizens living in the EU. And then there was to be a transition period and a whole lot followed by a curtailment of immigration. So you could say, well, that sounded fairly reasonable, and the North was to remain a full member of the customs union, while the rest of the UK would be on a temporary customs arrangement. Meanwhile, and this is the whole point that a lot of people miss, that if this agreement goes ahead, it allows for a whole lot of trade negotiations in the months ahead, and people often forget that. So the agreement that was arranged on the 14th of November appeared to be giving a bit for everybody, but almost immediately, Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab, who, let's be fair, he was the guy who was putting the whole affair together, and he hops out. So then poor Mrs. May had to go to Parliament and face 3 hours of absolute battering. So we have a lot ahead of us, basically.
And there's so many different layers to it. I know even just getting one little glimpse when there was that story last week of one food company starting to stockpile food and just looking at the number of foods, for example, that we take into Ireland from the UK, something like 4,500 products. In terms of what do you think is going to happen next? Is Theresa May going to be unseated, Susan? Will there be another referendum?
Well, I personally don't think she will be for two reasons. First of all, there isn't anybody who really wants to take up that job. Now, the problem for Mrs. May is that she cannot possibly please everybody. She can't please the Brexiteers who are saying she's been completely wet and tied up by the EU and, you know, she should just depart. And then the other side, the Remainers, who are like 48-49%, I think we don't want to go. We like our trade. We like the single market. We like the customs union. So she's trying to please everybody. And in fact, nobody is very pleased. But this is the problem, that it requires 48 letters to demand her resignation before a vote can take place within the Conservative Party to see should she go. Now, this is the problem. If that vote is lost and she stays, they cannot budge her for another 12 months, Wendy. But during that time, what would happen if Jeremy Corbyn manages to cause an election and the Conservatives are saying, but we're going into this election with a leader that we haven't confidence in and we can't remove? So there's that problem, because when the whole issue, the whole proposed deal, well, it has to be, it's finished off on Sunday, the 25th of November, that's this coming Sunday, in Brussels, with all the EU other member states saying, yes, we'll go along with it. They'll go along with it. It comes back to Westminster, and what everybody's saying, and I actually do not agree, everybody's saying, oh, it'll be voted down, the Brexiteers don't like it, the Remainers don't like it, but actually, it could go through. If it doesn't go through, Jeremy Corbyn's going to call an election.
And then in terms of if there's another election called, then the next question is, will there be another referendum on Brexit?
So Tony Blair is saying, and I've always admired Tony Blair, he's saying all along, the people who voted in 2016 did not know what they were voting for. They voted, they thought it sounded so glamorous, we'll take back our sovereignty, we'll give Brussels a big old kick and we'll stop all those migrants coming in. But actually, they hadn't thought through that the farmers, the industrialists, the producers, the small store owners, they really like trading with Europe. They want to keep trading. So this, I would say that the people of Britain, if you ask them again, I don't know how it would work out, but there are different arguments coming in. Other people say no. The British people would just say, if there was another referendum, we're so sick of this whole topic, let's just clear out and go. And then people are threatening and saying, well, there'll be all the lorries piled up in Dover, and what will we do? But, Wendy, can I just comment a little bit on the North? Because it is so interesting what's happening. That many analysts look at this and say, the North have got everything. They're going to be specially treated. They can stay in the customs union, whereas Britain really isn't in it completely. They won't have a border. And you could argue it's rather like Hong Kong in the Far East, where they can trade with everybody and do everything. So why are the DUP saying that they will vote against her? It is quite extraordinary, because business, farmers in the north, they're all saying, we don't want Brexit. So why are the DUP being so kind of just heavy on this and saying, no, we don't like it, it's letting us down and it means we're going to be cut off from Britain? And nobody can really understand that. Let's look at it another way. There's no functioning assembly in the north. There's nobody to speak properly.
So how is it even possible to negotiate and put forward these arguments?
And then, Wendy, the other thing I looked at was that Sinn Féin, as you know, I think they have 7 candidates for Westminster, but they don't take their seats, and that's up to them. But they're saying this Brexit deal is good for Northern Ireland. So that could be 7 whole votes if they went over and supported her, couldn't it?
Yeah, so that could really have an impact. Finally, just to ask you, Susan, obviously there's so many different layers to the impact that Brexit could and may have on Ireland. But at this point in time, with what we know, with what's been discussed with the draft deal and all that's happened in the intervening few days, what do you think the impact is for Ireland right now?
I think that it is so divided, it's quite hard to say. I think Mrs. May will survive, as I say, because nobody else wants that horrible job. Will it go through Parliament? That is the big problem. And you're getting a really wound-up situation, and you're getting some Brexiteers are pointing to Ireland because they're saying, if it wasn't for that border, if there wasn't a place where the EU joins what could be the UK, none of this would happen. The Brits would just clear out and they could do deals with America and they'd do really well. So those Brexiteers are actually criticising Ireland. They're saying, Ireland, you've been a thorn in the flesh of Britain for centuries. You know, you've always sided with Europeans when you shouldn't. You know, the Asgard brought in guns from Germany in Hoth in 1914, and the French army landed in 1798 in Mayo, and the Spanish fleet came to Kinsale in 1601. You Irish, you've been a thorn in our flesh. So there are so many sides to it. But if I think she'll survive, because I don't think anybody wants that job.
Susan Phillips, as always, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That was Susan Phillips giving us her thoughts on Brexit, the story so far. Reported that Theresa May is facing a battle to cling to power in the coming days because party rivals are threatening to unseat her as leader. Now, she has warned at the time, of course, it's a critical time at the moment because they're trying to achieve a successful Brexit. But what does a successful Brexit look like, and is the draft deal giving us a good picture of that? And will Theresa May survive? And maybe a good place to start is just the background to all of this, because there's been so much discussion, so much analysis, but actually, are the majority of us any the wiser? Well, our next guest will certainly help us to do just that, to get a little bit wiser and give us an update on the current situation in relation to Brexit. Our regular political commentator, Susan Phillips. Susan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Let's backtrack a little bit, okay? Let's just kind of go a bit more into where we are now and where we're going.
I think that's a good idea. The EEC started as an idea to stop France and Germany pulling the guts out of each other, which they had twice in the century. And it started as, I'm making it very simple, it started as a trading issue as well as a putting the weapons of destruction out of the way. And Britain and Ireland joined up at the same time, 1963. There were about 12 then. And it became a trading situation. Barriers came down, tariffs were removed, and it was a very popular idea. But the central Brussels, whatever you'd like to call them, the people in charge, began, it seemed, to make too many political rules. So trade, yes, but then difficult regulations. And the EU was becoming slightly criticized for having done that. So go back to Britain, and in June 2016, the British called for a referendum. It was David Cameron's idea because his backbenchers were saying, look, our constituents are getting very upset about these huge number of migrants coming into Britain. They're getting all the social securities, and we want to take back our sovereign colonialist, you know, empire-building perspectives. And to everybody's surprise, the Brexiteers, those are the ones that wanted to come out of the EU, just won. So fast forward a little bit, and Mrs. May has to put Article 50, which she had to obey her people, and Article 50 in March 2017 starts the process of removing Britain from the EU. However,
2 years later, we're still talking about it.
Yes, but Wendy, what happened was that not long after that, the EU, this is, and the UK, that's still Mrs. May, they signed up to this situation, which said, we will be negotiating, we'll have an argument, we'll have to have a divorce settlement, but we both agree there will be no hard physical customs post border between the north and the south of Ireland, because the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 has to be protected. And to put it in simple words, the IRA would reform at the next customs post. And that has been the basis of the whole problem, because it would be quite easy to do a deal. If you're going to do a Brexit deal, you'll say, right, we'll all move out. But you can't, when you've got this backstop which says that whatever happens, there will be no hard border. And that is the problem.
So it brings us forward now to what happened last week. I think it was last Wednesday that the draft deal was agreed. And people were kind of saying, you know, OK, a huge amount of work has been done. It didn't take long before, you know, opinion and analysis came in. And I see even Tony Blair writing an opinion piece today, basically saying that it's a bad deal for both sides. He says it isn't liked by the British Parliament or the British people, even a significant part of the remaining cabinet. Is he right?
Well, what happened was that on the 14th of November, the UK cabinet said, we have agreed a new draft deal. And they said, this is what it is. They said that the basis of this agreement, it was to be a little bit different from Chequers, because as you remember, after Chequers, which was a few months ago, David Davis and Boris Johnson, the two Brexiteers, they hopped out of the cabinet. So it had to be slightly harder for some and softer for others. And the basis of the agreement, which was announced on the 14th of November, you saw poor Mrs. May standing there saying her cabinet was united, which actually they were not. But the basis, Wendy, is very simple. It covered future trading relations. It covered the money, because the UK has to pay $39 billion. And you say, why? And it's because of money. It's for financial liabilities that accrued over a few years. So I think that's perfectly fair. And then it was the Northern Irish border and what happens to UK citizens living in the EU. And then there was to be a transition period and a whole lot followed by a curtailment of immigration. So you could say, well, that sounded fairly reasonable, and the North was to remain a full member of the customs union, while the rest of the UK would be on a temporary customs arrangement. Meanwhile, and this is the whole point that a lot of people miss, that if this agreement goes ahead, it allows for a whole lot of trade negotiations in the months ahead, and people often forget that. So the agreement that was arranged on the 14th of November appeared to be giving a bit for everybody, but almost immediately, Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab, who, let's be fair, he was the guy who was putting the whole affair together, and he hops out. So then poor Mrs. May had to go to Parliament and face 3 hours of absolute battering. So we have a lot ahead of us, basically.
And there's so many different layers to it. I know, even just getting one little glimpse when there was that story last week of one food company starting to stockpile food, and just looking at the number of foods, for example, that we take into Ireland from the UK, something like 4,500 products. In terms of what do you think is going to happen next? Is Theresa May going to be unseated, Susan?
Well,
will there be another referendum?
I don't think she will be, for two reasons. First of all, there isn't anybody who really wants to take up that job. Now, the problem for Mrs. May is that she cannot possibly please everybody. She can't please the Brexiteers, who are saying she's been completely wet and tied up by the EU and, you know, she should just depart. And then the other side, the Remainers, who are like 48-49%, I think we don't want to go. We like our trade. We like the single market. We like the customs union. See, she's trying to please everybody. And in fact, nobody is very pleased. But this is the problem, that it requires 48 letters to demand her resignation before a vote can take place within the Conservative Party to see should she go. Now, this is the problem. If that vote is lost and she stays, they cannot budge her for another 12 months, Wendy. But during that time, what would happen if Jeremy Corbyn manages to cause an election and the Conservatives are saying, but we're going into this election with a leader that we haven't confidence in and we can't remove? So there's that problem, because when the whole issue, the whole proposed deal, well, it has to be, it's finished off on Sunday, the 25th of November, that's this coming Sunday, in Brussels, with all the EU other member states saying, yes, we'll go along with it. Well, they will say they'll go along with it. It comes back to Westminster, and what everybody's saying, and I actually do not agree, everybody's saying, oh, it'll be voted down. The Brexiteers don't like it. The Remainers don't like it. But actually, it could go through. If it doesn't go through, Jeremy Corbyn's going to call an election.
And then in terms of if there's another election called, then the next question is, will there be another referendum on Brexit?
So Tony Blair is saying, and I've always admired Tony Blair, he's saying all along, the people who voted in 2016 did not know what they were voting for. They voted, they thought it sounded so glamorous, we'll take back our sovereignty, we'll give Brussels a big old kick and we'll stop all those migrants coming in. But actually, they hadn't thought through that the farmers, the industrialists, the producers, the small store owners, they really like trading with Europe. They want to keep trading. So this, I would say that the people of Britain, if you ask them again, I don't know how it would work out, but there are different arguments coming in. Other people say no. The British people would just say, if there was another referendum, we're so sick of this whole topic, let's just clear out and go. And then people are threatening and saying, well, there'll be all the lorries piled up in Dover, and what will we do? But, Wendy, can I just comment a little bit on the North? Because it is so interesting what's happening. Yeah. That many analysts look at this and say, the North have got everything. They're going to be specially treated. They can stay in the customs union, whereas Britain really isn't in it completely. They won't have a border. And you could argue it's rather like Hong Kong in the Far East, where they can trade with everybody and do everything. So why are the DUP saying that they will vote against it? It is quite extraordinary, because business, farmers in the North, they're all saying, we don't want Brexit. So why are the DUP being so kind of just heavy on this and saying, no, we don't like it, it's letting us down and it means we're going to be cut off from Britain? And nobody can really understand that. Let's look at it another way. There's no functioning assembly in the North. There's nobody to speak properly.
So how is it even possible to negotiate and put forward these arguments?
And then, Wendy, the other thing I looked at was that Sinn Féin, as you know, I think they have 7 candidates for Westminster, but they don't take their seats, and that's up to them. But they're saying this Brexit deal is good for Northern Ireland. So that could be 7 whole votes if they went over and supported her, couldn't it?
Yeah, so that could really have an impact. Finally, just to ask you, Susan, obviously there's so many different layers to the impact that Brexit could and may have on Ireland. But at this point in time, with what we know, with what's been discussed with the draft deal and all that's happened in the intervening few days, what do you think the impact is for Ireland right now?
I think that it is so divided, it's quite hard to say. I think Mrs. May will survive, as I say, because nobody else wants that horrible job. Will it go through Parliament? That is the big problem. And you're getting a really wound-up situation, and you're getting some Brexiteers are pointing to Ireland because they're saying, if it wasn't for that border, if there wasn't a place where the EU joins what could be the UK, none of this would happen. The Brits would just clear out and they could do deals with America and they'd do really well. So those Brexiteers are actually criticising Ireland. They're saying, Ireland, you've been a thorn in the flesh of Britain for centuries. You know, you've always sided with Europeans when you shouldn't. You know, the Asgard brought in guns from Germany in Hoth in 1914, and the French army landed in 1798 in Mayo, and the Spanish fleet came to Kinsale in 1601. You Irish, you've been a thorn in our flesh. So there are so many sides to it. But if I think she'll survive, because I don't think anybody wants that job.
Susan Phillips, as always, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That was Susan Phillips giving us her thoughts on Brexit, the story so far. Well, I will never forget the moment many, many years ago when my eldest brother, now Father Nicholas, told myself and the rest of our family that he was entering a seminary to study to be a priest. Well, you could have knocked me off the chair I was sitting on, because this was the last thing that I expected to hear him say. However, once I got over the shock and when I got to first visit him and to see exactly the life he was living, the life he was loving and enjoying, how happy he was, and indeed how happy many of the other brothers and sisters that were studying for a priesthood or religious life were, I was genuinely shocked, but also so happy that he was happy. So I think sometimes when it comes to understanding our vocation, and especially for those who are considering priesthood, our perception can often be very different of what the reality actually is. So it's great that there is an event that is going to be happening to really just do that, to offer that experience that I was blessed enough to have by virtue of having a brother studying to be a priest, that I was able to see what it was like. And it's going to be done by way of a retreat, which is called Come and See. And it's for men between 18 and 40 who are considering a vocation. And in studio now to tell us all about it and why the diocese of the country have decided to come together and do this, we have Eric Cooney. He's the administrator at the National Vocations Office. Eric, thanks so much for coming in to us this morning.
You're very welcome. Delighted.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the retreat for shortly, but yeah, Eric, you're an interesting guy because you were recently ordained a deacon. So what does that mean?
Well, yes, I was ordained as a permanent deacon. So I'm a married man. I've been married for 35 years. Always been involved in the church, in my parish, from liturgical music to Vincent de Paul to reader, different things. And perhaps at one stage in my life I would have considered being a priest, but then I realised for me my vocation was to marriage. And then when I heard back in 2002, 2004, that era, that the Irish bishops were looking at introducing the permanent diaconate in Ireland, I expressed interest. And finally in 2008, Archbishop Martin invited men forward. And I applied and I was selected, and then I was ordained as a permanent deacon in 2012.
So what do permanent deacons do? What role do they play within their parish?
Okay, it's a question I sort of always dread being answering. The role of a deacon, ideally, it is a threefold ministry to it. It's ideally to be a minister of charity. The word deacon comes from the Greek diaconia, or the Latin, and that's a ministry of service. So really to be of service to the people on the margins of society. So charity is one of the key pillars of being a deacon. The other two pillars are minister of the word and of altar. I think, unfortunately, had the Irish Church introduced the diaconate maybe 20, 30 years ago, when there was a plentiful amount of priests, then it would have been very easy to see the difference between a priest and a deacon. You would have seen the deacon on the altar, but there was still plenty of priests. I think, unfortunately now, because there is a shortage of priests in Ireland, and particularly in Dublin, people tend to see the deacon as being a replacement priest, which he's not. But in terms of a functional answer to your question, a deacon can baptise, can preside over funerals, weddings, benedictions, all prayer services. Really the three things that a deacon can't do from a sacramental perspective is we can't hear confession, we can't give the last rites, because in the last rites there's an implicit confession, forgiveness of sins, and we can't consecrate the Eucharist, so we can't say Mass. So
the reason it's also interesting, Eric, just it's great to hear your story of just how that journey of your involvement in the parish and then saying, OK, I'm going to go a step further. I'm going to study for the diaconate. And here you are today. Is your job now in terms of promoting vocations? It's interesting in two ways, because probably for a long time in Ireland, we didn't need to promote them at all. And then when they did start to be promoted, it was always a priest that promoted them. And it's been an interesting evolution, I suppose, when you look at the history, because obviously for many years, we were the ones who sent so many Irish priests on the missions and overseas. And now, of course, in one way, in other countries around the world, there is a lot of vocations in you know, Africa, India, places like that, and in the States as well. And we're getting priests here. But of course, when it comes to diocesan priesthood, having Irish priests is important, don't you think, in terms of encouraging that?
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, Irish priests, well, they come from our own culture. I think one of the challenges with foreign priests who've come over into some dioceses, in many cases their culture is different. Even right down, sometimes people find it hard to understand the way they speak English. That's, I don't mean to generalise, but it is obviously far better for us to be able to cultivate our own priests.
And do you think, in terms of this promotion of vocations, do you think it's just something that we need to kind of talk about more? And for, there might be a lot of young men that are considering entering the priesthood, but there's kind of an impression out there, well, if I even consider it, you know, that's it, decision made. And I remember the rector, for example, of my brother's seminary saying to me, don't worry, the door to enter is narrow, but the door to leave is very wide. In other words,
that's a good point.
There's been a huge shift in terms of there really is a heart and a spirit for it. Let's get the guys who really, this it really is their vocation and their calling. But also that you can come and see if it's for you. And that's, it doesn't mean it's a done deal.
Correct. Actually, you know, you've hit a really good point. It's really down to encouragement. And, you know, 40, 50 years ago, if somebody said, I'm thinking of becoming a priest, they would probably have received nothing but encouragement. Today, if somebody said, I'm thinking of becoming a priest, they probably are going to receive discouragement. Are you sure? It's a difficult life. I had a very interesting experience. Actually, this time last year, I was away in Chile with 16 priests from the Dublin Diocese. We were on a trip to Chile. Actually, my wife was with me, so she was the only woman among 17 clerics.
I'm sure she was well able for
you. Oh, she was absolutely well able. But one evening after dinner, one of the priests said to me, well, Eric, you've mentioned you're going out to Maynooth. What's this going out to Maynooth all about? And I said, oh, sorry, I thought you knew. I've just been appointed as the new administrator for the new National Vocations Office. And he got a little bit indignant and he asked everybody, you know, who was having their own conversations around the room, be quiet, everyone, be quiet. Did you all know that Eric was now the administrator for this new national office? Did anyone know there was a new national office? Did anyone know that Eric was appointed? And I suppose he was having a little bit of a rant about maybe poor communications, even though it had been publicised in Intercom and in other magazines. And then one other priest then started to say, oh, I have vocations. I don't know. If my nephew came to me and asked me about that he was interested in becoming a priest, I don't know that I would really encourage him. Now, the priest who was organising this trip was fantastic because he then turned around. He said, hang on a second, everybody. I'd like you all to reflect for a second. If I were to ask you a question and score between 0 and 5, 0 being very unhappy, 5 being elated and delighted, how happy and fulfilled are you in your ministry as a priest? If you were to live your life over again, would you make the same choices? And he left the question hang there for about 10, 15 seconds. And he said, I don't want you to answer it out loud, but I think most of you would probably have answered that question somewhere between 3 and 4. And there was a general nodding. Everyone agreed that they are actually happy with the choices they've made. He said, if I was to ask you a slightly similar but different question, your colleagues, how many of your brother priests that you know do you think are happy? Would they make the same choices all over again? And again, between 0 and 5. And he said, I think most of you would probably answer 1 or 2. And there was a general nodding. He said, look, you're no different to a group of guards, a group of teachers, a group of nurses. Because if you were to ask a nurse, are you happy with the decisions she's made to become a nurse? The answer is probably yes. But they'd say, but my colleagues are underworked, underpaid, undertrained.
There's a perception versus reality.
Exactly. Yeah. And the big issue is that people are not being encouraged today, which is the point you were making and I was latching onto. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops did a study a number of years ago, and they found that 80% of seminarians attributed their being in the seminary to the encouragement and inspiration of a priest or perhaps a family member. How often now are we encouraging people to enter? Another statistic I read in a different book was that 80% of the priests in the States have come from where? Now, if you probably were to look at a map, you'd probably be thinking of big cities and picking out. But 80% of priests have actually come from the 20% of parishes that pray for vocations.
Wow, that's an incredible stat that shows the power of prayer that we forget. I'm just thinking myself, Eric, do I pray for vocations regularly? Probably not, and I need to do that.
Yes, and it has only struck me, funny enough, recently enough, you know that famous scripture passage where that Jesus says, ask the Lord of the harvest to send vocations. And I'm always thinking, well, why isn't the Lord sending vocations? And then I really begin to think of ask the Lord. How many of us are actually praying for and encouraging vocations?
Well, that I know is something that this upcoming promotion is all about. Tell us a little bit about this Come and See retreat.
Okay,
Eric.
It's a very simple, short event. It's going to be on in Mount St. Anne's in Port Arlington. It's on this Friday evening. And it'll start at 6 o'clock with some supper. And then there'll be a talk and some night prayer and adoration. And the next morning, some more talks and breakfast, of course, and a bit of prayer. And then Eucharist and lunch. And it'll finish just shortly after lunchtime. So it's quite short. And it's just to give young men an opportunity just to take some time out and to explore, is priesthood something that might be of interest to them, that they maybe they already have that in their heart, but they've never been able to articulate it. And it'll give them an opportunity to meet other like-minded people and to meet a number of priests.
And just chat to them about
exactly,
their experience
exactly.
in the positive way.
And there's no big commitment, you know.
It's come and see. It is what it says.
Exactly. And that's what Jesus said to the disciples of John. Master, where do you live? Come and see.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be hopefully a blessed weekend, and we'll pray for the right people who feel that calling on their heart to be able to attend that. And I have to say, Eric, in my experience of all the interviews I've done over the years with lots of different priests from all walks of life and all life experiences, and I always ask them that, especially those who've been in priesthood a while, you know, if they could do it all over again, would they? And always they say yes. So I think encouragement is really, really important. So thank you so much, Eric, for joining us on the programme, and blessings to you in your newish role.
If I could just say that if anyone is interested, time is not on their side because it's this Friday. So if they are interested, our website is vocations.ie. And if they'd like to send off an email to me, info@vocations.ie.
Perfect. Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. As Eric mentioned there, the details for the Come and See retreat is a short overnight retreat taking place this Friday evening from 6, that's Friday the 23rd, until the following Saturday in the afternoon in Mount St Anne's in Kilnard near Port Arlington. And you can get all the details on vocations.ie. Well, we talked to our next guest, who is a former UK ambassador to Syria, back in April, while the West was preparing to bomb Syria as a retaliation for an alleged chemical gas attack in a place called Douma. Peter Ford at that time was warning against such an action and urging other governments to allow investigations to take their course before this action was taken. His warnings proved to be well-founded, as we discovered a few days later when we interviewed journalist Robert Fisk, the first foreign journalist to find the clinic in Douma, and learned that there was a strong possibility that no chemical attack had taken place at all. But let me ask you this. Do you know that Ireland is participating in sanctions against Syria? Something Peter Ford believes is an enormous injustice. He's in Ireland this week to speak at a number of events calling for the lifting of these sanctions, and he's on the line to tell us more. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Peter, I think that a lot of people wouldn't actually be aware about the sanctions that have been imposed on Syria. You might just give us a little bit of what they mean and the background to them.
Well, these sanctions are horrendous and causing terrible suffering in Syria, as though people weren't suffering enough already from the war. We are piling pain upon misery with these EU sanctions, which are on a level with those which were applied to Iraq. I think there's more awareness of how damaging Iraq sanctions were before the overthrow of Saddam. Well, in Syria, they are just as bad. They've been described by the UN as among the most far-reaching and complicated sanctions ever applied in history. But we don't hear about them. We should, and that's why I'm here in Dublin today.
Why do we not hear about them, Peter, in your opinion?
Well, because there is an effective news blackout on anything except the accepted media narrative about Syria, which goes something like this, that Assad is a monster who just kills people and bombs hospitals for the sheer hell of it. And we, the Western powers, have to punish him, and that's why we have sanctions and all the rest. But regardless of whether Assad is a monster or not, and he's not, perhaps I can come back to that, but regardless, the sanctions only hurt the ordinary Syrians. I mean, this happens almost always with sanctions, unless it's very, very carefully targeted and selective. But the worst sanctions are in Syria are the ones applied to banking. It's virtually impossible for Syrians to trade in dollars or euros because of EU and American sanctions.
So these are sanctions that are just affecting ordinary, everyday, innocent citizens.
It affects virtually everything. Anything that requires a bank transfer, essentially. So the banks run a mile when they hear that a trader wants to pass a transaction through Damascus. They're afraid of incurring billions of dollars of fines, and in fact some banks have incurred such fines. So you can imagine the dampener this puts on virtually all trade. The result has been a tripling of the price of wheat flour, very basic commodity, a 600% rise in the price of rice, and a doubling of the price of fuel. Ordinary Syrians are paying the price for this. And it's not as though the sanctions were working. Theoretically, their purpose is not to punish, but to change the behavior of the Syrian government. Well, that obviously hasn't worked. Sanctions have been on for 7 or 8 years now, and they transparently haven't made a blind bit of difference to the behavior of the Syrian government, which thinks that it's acting in self-defense. So the sanctions don't work, and they just cause misery for ordinary Syrians.
In terms of just, I mean, I think, again, Peter, people would be shocked to hear just the practical implications just for ordinary people. And I have to say, it feels to me a very sad irony because, of course, over the years, we've had many call outs from a charitable perspective from ordinary Irish people to support those Syrians who are suffering. Yet these sanctions are some of the reasons that people can't afford to fill their car or pay for rice. In terms
it gets even worse because one of the sectors that has suffered most is the healthcare sector. People can't import prostheses, and a lot of people have lost limbs in Syria. A lot of people can't get the cancer treatments because the banking transactions won't allow it. So, you know, we the West, we complain that Assad's bombing hospitals, but we actually cause more deaths and suffering through our sanctions than are ever hit through bombing.
In terms of just some of the very obvious problems that are being caused by these sanctions, Peter, are there any governments that are standing back and saying, OK, this has been going on for 7-8 years, it's not working, what are we going to do about it? Or is it a head in the sand situation?
It's a head in the sand situation. Governments are afraid to admit that sanctions are pointless and just vindictive, so they keep them on out of laziness, stubbornness, and sheer vindictiveness, because they have no utility whatever. And sadly, there's no pressure on governments, because public opinion is not awake to the fact that the sanctions are hurting ordinary Syrians. And the Syrian government itself doesn't make a huge song and dance about this, because they are proud. Syrians are a very proud people. They don't like to admit that their fate lies in the hands of the EU or anybody else. But it does. And we have it in our power. The members of the EU have it in their power to ease a great deal of the suffering in Syria. And this would not help the government, the Syrian government. It wouldn't help them militarily. But there's another wrinkle in these sanctions, dual-use items. Supposedly, the one bit of the sanctions are only supposed to apply to oil field equipment, but that means that all pipes and pumps cannot be imported. And the water industry, sanitation, also require pumps and pipes. So the result is that Syrians don't have fresh water, they're falling ill, and they suffer from raw sewage spilling out.
In terms of the awareness, and I know you're going to be addressing some members of the Oireachtas and Leinster House on your visit here to Ireland, is there an appetite, Peter, and indeed I'm just thinking of some of our own politicians, is there even an awareness of some of these implications of the sanctions against Syria from publicly elected representatives?
Very, very few. To her credit, Claire Daly, And his credit, Mick Wallace and one or two others have done their best to highlight the sanctions issue. Catherine Connolly also. But there's voices in the wilderness and in Britain. There's virtually nobody.
In terms of just the attitude that you've experienced, Peter, and I have to say we've done our utmost here on Spirit Radio to do something which I think is very important, where we've tried to speak to journalists who are on the ground in these places rather than taking something that's coming down the wires from somebody sitting in an office in New York or Paris or wherever. And every time we touch on the Syria issue, I certainly get a swathe of negative things online saying, I'm pro-Assad. What do you think of that accusation, and does that happen to you as well?
Yes, you get smeared. This has happened to me. The Daily Telegraph in London accused me of having a job with Assad's family, of being a lobbyist. This is all lies. They had to retract. I don't receive a penny. It costs me money, actually, to campaign as I do. But, you know, mud sticks. And you do an internet search, and it's the original story, the smear, which will pop up. That's the way they try to smother all sane and objective discussion of Syria.
What would be your message when you're going to be speaking at the events this week, and indeed your message to Irish members of the Oireachtas?
I'm sorry?
What's your message going to be at the events that you're speaking at this week in Ireland, Peter?
The message is that is to lift sanctions, that Irish parliamentarians and members of the European Parliament should take an initiative in pushing for the lifting of sanctions. Why not Ireland? There's more awareness here, at least on the part of a few active members of Parliament. This is an area where Ireland could make a difference. Ireland also has much in common with Syria because it suffered, like Syria is suffering from partition. This is another thing that's happening. Western governments are effectively occupying parts of Syria and trying to split the country up into a Kurdish area and a Sunni area. This is just furthering the cause of sectarianism. Basically, the Syrian government are trying to protect a unified, secular Syria where all the religions are equal. And their opponents, the jihadis, are trying to create a Sunni supremacist like they have in Saudi Arabia. So there is an opportunity for Irish public opinion and Irish parliamentarians to do something that's never going to happen, sadly, in Britain. For one thing, we are shooting ourselves in the foot by leaving the EU, so we no longer have any influence there. But hopefully Ireland will take up the cause.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. I do hope that you will find that your visit here to Ireland is not in vain. That was Peter Ford there, who is going to be holding an information meeting, by the way, with members of the Oireachtas in Leinster House, which has been organised by Independence for Change. And that's actually on this evening at 8 o'clock. And Monday evening. This evening, for everybody else, at 8 o'clock, there's going to be a conversation with Vincent Brown, the well-known journalist and broadcaster, in the Unite Hall in Middle Abbey Street in Dublin. Dublin. So that's, if you're interested in attending that, that's this evening, 8 p.m. Vincent Brown is going to be hosting the conversation in the Unite Hall in Middle Abbey Street in Dublin. And he's also going to speak at a public meeting in Galway entitled Lift Sanctions of Syria on Tuesday the 20th of November at 8 p.m. in Richardson's Air Square. That was former British ambassador to Syria.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.